Howdy, this is Alan Bocal, I'm a volunteer here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. You can't sleep, so you're listening to this drivel. So without any further ado, I'm going to read some funny stuff to you for the next 28 minutes, and I hope you enjoy your listening to this. I think it's funny, but, you know, that's my sense of humor, and, you know, humor is rather subjective, as you know. So without any further ado, I'm going to read this stuff, and we'll go from there. Mr. Smith goes to the doctor's office to collect his wife's test results. The lab tech says to him, "I'm sorry, sir, but there's been a bit of a mix-up, and we have a problem. When we sent the samples from your wife to the lab, the samples from another Mrs. Smith were sent as well, and we now are uncertain which one is your wife's. Frankly, that's either bad or terrible." "What do you mean?" "Well, one Mrs. Smith had tested positive for Alzheimer's disease and the other for AIDS. We can't tell which is your wife's." "That's terrible. Can't we do the test over?" asked Mr. Smith. "Normally, yes, but you have an HMO, and they won't pay for those expensive tests more than once." "What am I supposed to do now?" "The HMO recommends that you drop your wife off in the middle of town. If she finds her way home, don't sleep with her." A Russian and American wrestler were sent to square off for the Olympic gold medal. Before the final match, the American wrestler's trainer came to him and said, "Now, don't forget all the research we've done on this Russian. He's never lost a match because of this pretzel hold he has. Whatever you do, don't let him get you into this hold. If he does, you're finished." The wrestler nodded in acknowledgement. As the match started, the American and the Russian circled each other several times, looking for an opening. All of a sudden, the Russian lunged forward, grabbing the American and wrapping him up in the dreaded pretzel hold. A sigh of disappointment arose from the crowd, and the trainer buried his face in his hands, for he knew all was lost. He couldn't watch the inevitable happen. Suddenly, there was a scream and then a cheer from the crowd, and the trainer raised his eyes just in time to watch the Russian go flying up in the air. His back hit the mat with a thud, and the American collapsed on top of him, making the pin and winning the match. The trainer was astounded. When he finally got the American wrestler alone, he asked, "How did you ever get out of that hold? No one has ever done it before." The wrestler answered, "Well, I was ready to give up when he got me in that hold, but at the last moment, I opened my eyes and saw his genitals right in front of my face. I had nothing to lose, so with my last ounce of strength, I stretched out my neck and bit those babies just as hard as I could." So the trainer exclaimed, "That is what finished him off?" "Not really, but you'd be amazed how strong you get when you bite your own junk." Ba-dum-bum. Okay, we got that done. I'm now going to read from Dave Barry's book, You May Date Boys When You're 40. Okay, Dave Barry, as you all know, is a great comedian, great comedy writer. So there. "Being a professional author is a great job. You get to work at home, be your own boss, and wear whatever you want. Fact, Ernest Hemingway wrote The Sun Also Rises wearing a penguin costume. Another benefit of being a professional author is you also have complete freedom to snack. I eat as many as 45 distinct snacks per day. My typical schedule is I spend several minutes working on writing something, this sentence, for example, and then I'll think to myself, quote, snack time. Then I'll head to the kitchen to see what's available. There's basically nothing in my kitchen that I have not, at one time or another, as a professional author, smeared peanut butter on. I include potholders in that statement. And then there is the pay. It's excellent. I'm not saying that you will right off the bat, with no author experience, make the kind of money Stephen King makes. Achieving that level of success can take literally years. But the potential is there, especially if you are a fast typist, because the standard practice in the writing industry is to pay authors by the word. Let me repeat that statement for emphasis. The standard practice in the industry is to pay authors by the word. At this point, you are thinking to yourself in your mind, wait a minute. Is he saying that the standard practice in the industry is to pay authors by the word? Yes, that is what I'm saying. Specifically, I'm saying that the standard practice in the industry is to pay authors by the word. Another thought you may have is, do I have what it takes to make the grade as a professional writer? I will answer that question with a brutal and unflinching honesty. Yes. Don't be discouraged. If you have no formal training in the field of writing, writing is not one of those activities that require a specific skill, such as golf, opera, or radiator repair. You can be a writer. Anyone can be a writer. Fact, William Shakespeare, who's responsible for some of the greatest works of Western literature, including the original version of West Side Story, was raised in a rural village without any formal education and could neither read nor write nor speak English. Many historians now believe he may actually have been a horse. Fact, when J.K. Rowling wrote the first Harry Potter book, she was a single mother on welfare who was both blind and deaf and had been chained to a dungeon wall for 11 years upside down. Fact, John Grisham is from Mississippi. If those individuals were able to overcome such hardships and become successful writers, there's no reason why you can't. So let's get started. The first step is to have a snack. 30-minute break. Okay, time to get started. How to break into the writing field. Let's get one thing straight. There are no shortcuts to becoming a successful published author. It takes determination and a lot of plain old hard work. You cannot just sit around and wait for a literary success to be dropped on you out of the sky by some magical success-pooping seagull. No, you must roll up your sleeves, plant yourselves in front of your computer, and perform the difficult and lonely task of writing a letter to a successful author asking for free advice. This is the only known way to succeed as a writer. We published authors receive such letters all the time. Mine generally sound like this. Dear Mr. Barry, I'm a recent college graduate or stay-at-home mother of three or corporate attorney or 87-year-old retiree or prison inmate or vice president of the United States, and I am a big fan of your writing, especially your book, Hoot, which was hilarious. Anyway, the reason for this letter is that I am looking for some guidance, and I'm hoping you can provide it. While not a published author myself, I have done some writing in my spare time, and my friends or parents or college professors or cellmates or goldfish or alien abductors have all told me that my tongue-in-cheek style of humor reminds them of you. Mr. Barry, I know that you are a very busy person, so I will cut to the chase. I'm hoping you will take a look at the enclosed selection of my humorous essays or the 873-page manuscript of my comic novel about a corporate attorney who becomes involved in a series of wacky depositions, or my collection of family Christmas newsletters from 1987, or the Akron, Ohio Yellow Pages, or my handwritten account of the many humorous events that have occurred during my 43-year career in the field of dental implants. I am specifically wondering if you think that I have what it takes to make the grade as a pro writer, and if so, what steps I should take next. Would you be interested in polishing up my work for publication? I would, of course, give you full credit. Also, would it be possible for you to put in a good word for me with your publisher? I understand that in order to get published, it's a good idea to have an agent, and I am hoping you can recommend one. I would also be grateful for any tricks of the trade that you can pass along to a rookie, such as the do's and don'ts of putting words inside quotation marks. I also have developed this weird lamp on my right elbow, weird lump on my right elbow, and I'm wondering if you think I should have it looked at. Thank you so much, Mr. Barry. Sincerely, and the name. P.S. Please write back soon because the lump is changing color. We professional authors receive many letters like this. Whenever one arrives, we immediately drop whatever we are doing so we can analyze this letter's writer's specific situation and develop a detailed plan of action for his or her writing career. Bear in mind that this takes time. If you write to one of the more popular authors, James Patterson, for example, or the late Jane Austen, you need to be patient, as they might be busy providing consultation services for other aspiring authors. Also, allow 2 weeks for the author to get back to you. After that, you should consider a follow-up letter or personal visit to your author's residence to see how your career plan is coming along. Your first book contract. Once your author has found you an agent and a publisher, you will need to sign a book contract which is a lengthy legal document that says the author warrants blah, 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 blah. Don't worry about the exact contents of the contract. The only important thing in there is the size of your advance, which is a sum of money that the publisher pays you before you have actually written the book. That's right. You get this money up front. I realize it sounds crazy. It's like taking a college course where the professor gives you an A on a paper you haven't even written yet. But there's a sound, logical reason for this system. Namely, the book publishing industry has no idea what it's doing. The size of your first advance will depend on a great many factors. It should be around $1 million. Writing a book. At some point during the decade after you sign the contract, the publisher is going to start asking you whiny questions about when you expect to finish your book. In your contract, your publisher will say, you specifically warranted that blah, 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 blah. As if you, a busy professional author, are supposed to remember every single thing you sign. But the point is, there are many times comes a time when you have to physically write a book. This is the worst part of being a professional author because you have to sit around thinking up words for days on end, which is unbelievably boring. After you become more established, you can skip this pesky chore by doing what many top authors do, namely think up book ideas, but hire cheap foreign labor to write the actual books. If you go to that route, make sure you read your book before you pass it along to the publisher, because many foreign laborers don't have a strong grasp of English, and sometimes they will totally screw up your idea. Fact: The Hunger Games, as originally conceived by the author, was supposed to be a three-book series on the historical impact of salad dressing. But as a rule, your publisher will expect you to write your first book all by yourself. This means you will have to choose a genre. For your first effort, I recommend that you write a children's book. This genre has a couple of advantages. For one thing, you're writing for children, and children are, let's face it, not the sharpest quills on the porcupine. You can write pretty much any idiot thing you want, and they will be fine with it. Also, children's books are typically just 24 pages long and consist of almost entirely of large illustrations, so that the total number of words you have to write is about the same as a standard grocery list. Fact: The average children's book author works 2 hours per year. The one important rule of children's books is that they have to teach an important lesson. Here's the basic format. Merle Moth does a big thing. Page 1, Merle Moth loved to eat. Eat, 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 page 2. Page 3, Merle ate socks. Page 4, Merle ate coats. Page 5, Merle even ate hats. Page 6, one day Merle saw a blue shirt. Page 7, I will eat the shirt. Page 8, but Merle could not eat the shirt. Page 9, this shirt tastes bad, Merle told his friends. Page 10, because it's made from oil, said Tyrone Toad. Page 11, what is oil, said Merle. Page 12, it's a non-renewable resource, said Erlene, the endangered fruit bat. Page 13, oh no, said Merle. Page 14, oil hurts the earth, said Carlos Cicada, who was transgendered. Page 15, oh no, said Merle again, for he knew the book needed to reach 24 pages. Page 16, yes, said Reggie, the lactose-intolerant raccoon, we must save the earth from oil. Page 17, but I am so small, said Merle, how can I save the earth from oil? Page 18, I know, said Farouk, the differently abled Muslim sea urchin. You can fly deep into the ear canal of a petrochemical executive and tell him to stop hurting the earth with oil. Page 19, and that is what Merle did. Page 20, soon the earth was saved. Page 21, Merle was happy. Page 22, I learned an important lesson, he said. Even if you are small, you can make a big difference. Page 23, you can say that again, said Antoine, a vegan amoeba of color. Page 24, everyone laughed and laughed, but not at anyone else. The end. The downside to this children's book genre is that this is a well-known inside the publishing industry. It's impossible to keep cranking out this kind of crap without turning to hard drugs. Fact: The Very Hungry Caterpillar is actually about the author's long, desperate struggle with crystal meth. For this reason, you might want to consider another low workload, high pay genre, poetry. There is big money to be made here because poetry is extremely popular with the American consumer. Bookstores literally cannot keep poetry books on the shelves. This is why when you go to the bookstore, you never see poetry books on the shelves. Wait a minute, I hear you saying. Isn't it hard to write a poem? It used to be. In the old days, there were strict rules requiring that the poems had to rhyme and contain a certain number of syllables per line and be at least a vaguely comprehensible to humans. Writing these old-style poems was backbreaking work, which is why the men who did it are virtually all dead today from various causes. But then in the early 19th or 20th century, a group of brilliant young research poets working late at night at the National Poetry Laboratory accidentally mainlined some heroin and invented free verse, which is a kind of poetry that has no rules at all. Now any random clot of unpunctuated words could be a poem. Suddenly, in the morning, always in the morning, the moment comes when you are shuffling, sleep slowed down the dawn dim hallway, shuffling in your nightdress. It comes so sudden, so cold, so suddenly cold when it comes, the dog nose in your butt, by T.S. Eliot. Free verse totally revolutionized the poetry industry. It meant that the entire lifetime output of an old-style poet such as Milton Wordsworth Longfellow could be equaled in a single afternoon by a bored homemaker with a bottle of Zinfandel. The point is, you can definitely do it. And because of the great high consumer demand for poetry, the money is great. Fact, 86% of all private jets are owned by poets. Also, it goes without saying that as a poet, you will be a major international celebrity. You will have front row seats for every concert and be whisked past the line of loser normal people into an exclusive restaurant or nightclub you want, not to mention having casual sex with as many as four Kardashians per day. If that sounds too hygienic, you might want to consider becoming a novelist. This is a little harder than writing poetry or children's books, but not much. The two big decisions you'll have to make are, will it be a woman's novel or a man's novel? Will there be vampires? Once you have answered these questions, all you have to do is come up with characters and a plot that contains a beginning, a middle, and a surprise ending. Use this table for reference. Elements of a novel. Woman's novel. Main character. Female. Strikingly beautiful. Highly intelligent. Sensitive. Has many feelings. Millions and millions of feelings. Very attractive to men. Also very attractive to women. Also very attractive to vampires, if there are any in the plot. Just generally an extremely attractive person. Men's novel. Male, masculine, ruggedly handsome, brave, manly, highly intelligent, fearless, a renegade and a loner. Dislikes authority, courageous, strong, and very good at fighting, but reluctant to use violence. Understood to possess, although this is never explicitly stated, a huge penis. Other principal characters. Woman's novel. The main character's mother or sister or daughter or childhood friend from whom she has been estranged or has an ambivalent relationship. Other females whose function is to have a long conversations with the man, with the main character, about her numerous feelings and relationship complexities. Several strikingly handsome males or vampires who are, it goes without saying, powerfully attracted to the main character. Men's novel. A serial killer or sex pervert, basement torturer, or powerful politician or business person, or criminal with numerous henchpersons. High-ranking yet idiotic police, military, or government officials who detest renegade loners. A highly professional yet beautiful female police or military officer or lawyer with a tough outer shell, yet, at the same time, a certain emotional vulnerability, yet at the same time, a nice pair of gazumbas. Beginning. We are gradually introduced to the world of the main character. We slowly begin to understand, through her innermost thoughts and her conversations with other female characters, that because of some mysterious traumatic incident that occurred in the past, she has deeply conflicted feelings about her complex relationship with her mother, sister, daughter, and/or estranged childhood friend. We also are introduced to one or more of the males to whom the main character is attracted, but about whom she has many deeply ambivalent feelings that result in much conflicted thinking going on for pages and pages. The main character is thrust into a situation where he encounters some wrongdoing being done and through no fault of his own must reluctantly beat the living shit out of some henchpersons. This results in a string of mysterious clues that cause the main character to realize that there is an evil plot afoot involving worldwide nuclear destruction or serial killing or sex pervert basement torturing with soldering irons or the president of the United States being a communist robot or some other hideous evil plot that the main character must courageously try to uncover single-handedly against impossible odds. Middle. Through the continued conversations with other female characters as well as additional lengthy passages of the innermost thoughts, we gradually learn more about the complex feelings and relationships of the main character, getting glimpses, but only glimpses, of the mysterious traumatic past incident that is causing her to have so much emotional complexity in her life. At the same time, she gradually becomes involved in a deeper and more complex relationship with one or more of the male characters, yet she is unable to commit herself fully to him or them because of so many sensitive and innermost ambivalent feelings swarming around inside of her like minnows in a bait bucket. The main purpose, bravely pursuing the truth, finds his path blocked time and again by henchpersons out of whom he has no choice but to reluctantly beat the living shit. This draws the attention of a highly ranking police, military, or government officials who naturally get everything completely wrong and focus their suspicions on the main character. They assign him to investigate him, the tough yet beautiful Ganzumba woman. She and the main character take an instant dislike to each other and soon have amazing sex lasting several days thanks to the awesome power of the unstated but clearly understood Yule log in his undershorts. Surprise ending. As the main character's feeling reaches a raging fever pitch of ambivalence, she has a climactic emotional conversation or encounter involving her mother, sister, daughter, or estranged childhood friend. And we finally, after many hundreds of pages, discover the mysterious traumatic past event has caused so much internal conflict and relationship complexity. It turns out to be a shocking surprise. By finally getting it out into the open, the main character is able to confront it and have many additional pages of conversations and thoughts and feelings about it. In the end, she is able to at least to accept herself as the highly attractive woman she is and to admit the love she feels for one or more of the male characters and possibly allow him to suck out her blood. The book ends here because of the danger that some actual action is about to occur. The main character and the woman who has, of course, fallen in love with him become ensnared in a hopeless plot predicament from which escape is absolutely completely 100% impossible, so they are definitely going to die. They respond by having sex of a caliber that would kill a rhinoceros. Then they escape in a very clever and brave way and proceed to an action-packed climax in which the main character, against impossible odds, reluctantly kills a minimum of 135 people en route to discovering the incredible shocking truth, which is something totally unexpected. With the plot now resolved, the main character and the women again engage in lovemaking so powerful that it alters worldwide bird migration patterns, although she knows in her heart that he will never settle down with one woman because of his renegade loner lifestyle and the massive, unstated pelvic salami. Promoting your book. The surest way to make your book a bestseller is to get my wife to read it. If she likes it, she will make it a bestseller. She has done this repeatedly. Remember a book called The Kite Runner? That was my wife. Of the 10 million copies of that book sold, at least 9.8 million were purchased by people who were directly ordered to do so by my wife. Not only did she make everybody in her vast international network of book-reading women friends buy it, but she also would walk up to complete strangers in bookstores and say, "Have you read The Kite Runner? It's a great book." Then she would basically hover around them until they had no choice but to buy The Kite Runner, even if they already owned it, or for that matter, even if they owned the bookstore. Remember the U.S. Airways flight? The Herald pilot, Chesley Sullenberger, landed in the Hudson River after both engines died and the passengers all miraculously survived. If my wife had been on the flight when she and the other passengers were standing on the plane wings waiting for the rescue boats, she would have taken the opportunity to tell them that they needed to buy The Kite Runner. Other books that my wife has, by relentlessly hectoring innocent bystanders, personally turned into bestsellers include The Bridges from Madison County, Room, and The Language of Flowers. Now to answer your questions. No, my wife has never made any of my books into bestsellers. Yes, I am her husband, unlike, say, the author of The Kite Runner. No, I'm not bitter. Really, I'm fine with it. Shut up. But you cannot rely entirely on my wife to promote your book for you. You will also have to do some promoting yourself. One effective technique, especially for the first-time authors, is to march into the bookstores and inform the staff in a loud yet irritated voice that you don't have enough copies of your book and don't have it displayed prominently enough and clearly not enough doing an adequate job of informing the customers about it. Bookstore employees really appreciate receiving this kind of helpful input from authors and will definitely pay special attention to your books after you leave the book tour. As a best-selling author, you'll be sent out on a book tour, which is a multi-city trip starting out in the New York City and ending in death. Ha ha, I'm exaggerating, of course. Only 8% of the book tours are fatal to the author. Nevertheless, book tours can be grueling because you go from city to city, appearing on TV and radio shows where you'll be interviewed by perky on-air personalities who have not read your book and sincerely do not give a shit about it. If they are interested in books, they would never have gotten into the radio or TV in the first place. So it's up to you, the author, to carry the ball during these interviews, and it can be hard work, as we see in this classic author interview transcript from the early days of radio. Host, our next guest is Herman Melville, who has written a book called Moby Dick. Melville. Dick. Host, I beg your pardon. It's Dick. What is? The book's titled It's Moby Dick. Host, Dick? Yes, it's the name of a whale, which is a major character in the book. Folks, that's all the time we have. Hope you liked it. Be well. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.